At Pluralsight, we don't just teach skills. We are building the tech workforce who deliver results fast, accelerated by top-tier content. Lead with confidence. Lead with expertise. Visit us at Pluralsight.com to tap in and learn more.
So, Matt, today when I was walking down the street, I got hit by a flute, a clarinet, and a violin.
What?
Yeah, it was an orchestrated attack.
You know what? As ridiculous as that is, I liked it. You know, I liked it.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the graveyard. Thank you for joining us tonight. My name is Adam.
And my name's Matt.
Now, pull up a tombstone or settle into your casket and get comfortable, because this is Graveyard Tales.
All right, everybody, here we are again. Matt, how you doing tonight, brother?
Man, I am pretty good.
Good, good. So before we get into it, we'll say go over to patreon.com/graveyardtales. You can sign up to become a patron. If you're like, you know what, I need more content from Adam and Matt. And despite me despising the word content, I'm still using it in this sense, because we've got a bunch of it over on Patreon.
We sure do.
We've got years of back catalog, and we've got 3 different levels that you can sign up for. You can sign up 1, 5, or 10. All levels get a bonus episode a week. Our $5 a month, they get the video version. At $5 and $10, they get the video version of the bonus episode. And then our $10 a month, they get that. Plus, they get the ad-free audio and video versions of the main episode. Plus, they get our second show, Side Quest. So if you want to hear Matt and I talk about things that are not Graveyard Tales related, you know, if you want to hear us talk like we would sitting around the house with each other, that's the place to go. Go over there, sign up, become a $10 patron. We do a bunch of stuff on SideQuest.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You name it. We've probably tried it. And yep. Then some.
Yep. Exactly. And Matt, here's the thing. I wish we were a big enough show to not have to say this, but we're not yet. So if you would do us a favor and go leave us a review and a rating over on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast from, leave us a review. That helps bump us up in the charts. So when people are searching for podcasts, we get recommended, or it'll just recommend us in the, hey, if you like this show, then you'll like Graveyard Tales. And the more reviews we get, the more ratings we get, the more we bump up.
Yeah.
And you can say whatever, as long as it's nice. Yeah. You know, give us a recipe for red beans and rice, or, you know, butter cookies or something, and then give us a 5-star rating and we'll be happy.
Look, if buying a Patreon subscription or whatever is just not your thing, but you still want to help Adam and I and the show, that is the easiest and most effective way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
I assure you, it really helps, and we appreciate it.
Oh, yeah, very much. So, on that note, Matt, I'll stop my boring housekeeping early, because this is going to be a ride.
Yeah.
So, why don't you tell us, what are we talking about tonight, brother?
So, tonight, Adam had reached out to me. We were kind of going back and forth with about, I don't know, 2 or 3 different topics, trying to decide what we wanted to do when we chose this. And Adam had this idea. He said, I would love to find a true crime story that would kind of be outside of the norm for what we do, but there are hauntings associated with the crime, either the crime scene or the individual or whatever. And I said, that's a really interesting idea. Something along the lines of the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Yeah.
Okay. So we got to looking. And we found this case, which I don't know about you, Adam. I had never heard of this.
I hadn't either.
Which is surprising, given that for about 3 years, Amanda was like the true crime maniac on podcasts, that she hadn't come across this and laid out this story for me.
Right.
Okay. But this is the case of serial killer Herb Baumeister.
Mm-hmm.
And this dude, again, when you hear all this, you're kind of go, why have I not heard about this guy?
Mm-hmm.
Serial killer. He was confirmed to have murdered at least 11 people.
At least.
And the farm where he lived and carried out these grisly attacks is called Fox Hollow Farm, and it is ridiculously haunted.
Yeah.
So tonight we're going to give you a little twist on Graveyard Tales. We are going to discuss the true crime of Herb Baumeister and the haunting of his former residence.
Yep.
So, as Adam said, sit back. This is going to be a ride.
Yeah.
All right. I know that my information is not gruesome and descriptive. I can't say that necessarily for Adam's.
Mine is.
If listening to details about something like this is, you know, kind of turns your stomach, you might want to, you know, put your fingers in the ears for, you know, a minute or two when Adam starts describing, what this guy did.
I'll try to give a heads up.
Okay.
Before we get into any of the stuff.
Because that's what I'm
going to
do. I don't.
Yeah. And Matt's right. We were looking for cases. And before we even get into this, Matt, I got to ask you this. So I was looking stuff up. And I don't know why I never thought about this before, but there are no associated hauntings with BTK, with Gacy, or Dahmer that I can find.
Yeah.
And I don't understand why with such a big case that there wouldn't be, but the only thing I can think of is either A, there was resolution with that case that allowed them to move on, or B, because the victims were so spread out. But when you get into our case, they were spread out as well. But I can't understand why when you look up BTK, there's no associated hauntings with BTK.
I don't know. Maybe he's still alive, right? He's still alive and in prison, I believe.
Maybe.
Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know. You mentioned John Wayne Gacy. That's one that you would really think that there would be something attached to his place.
Yep.
You know, because, you know, they found remains buried all over his property too.
But I think if I'm not mistaken, they tore that house down and rebuilt.
Yeah.
So maybe, but we know the land has a lot to do with it. So I don't know. It's just,
it would be interesting to know if anybody's actually had any kind of experience on that property, regardless of what building is there now.
Right.
But I don't know. And I think a lot of skeptics, when we talk about, you know, hauntings specifically, they always come up with why are all these supposed ghosts from like the 1700s? from like the late or the early 1800s. You know, why aren't we seeing the ghost of somebody, you know, that died 2 weeks ago? And I'm like, there are. They're just not as common.
Or publicized.
Or publicized, exactly. You know, the research hadn't been done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the investigations haven't been done. Some of these places we talk about, they've had haunted history for 50 years plus.
Right.
There's been a lot of time for people to, you know, enthusiasts or paranormal investigators to dig into some of these stories and actually go and experience them. You know, somebody that, you know, they did all this stuff in like, you know, the 2000s or something. There may just not be, but there are indeed cases of, you know, modern deaths with modern hauntings. They're just not as common. But I think this one 100% qualifies to be in that category.
I agree. Because it wasn't that long ago.
Yeah, no, it wasn't that long ago at all.
But before we get too off track, we'll say go check our sources. Down in the bottom of the show notes, you can find where we found all the information. And with mine, I know for sure there's some minutia and stuff that I left out for sake of time, since we're not 100% a true crime show. We are a paranormal show. So you got to leave room for the paranormal. And if I'd have touched on all the minutia, we'd have had one episode true crime followed by a second episode of paranormal, which may have to happen at some point if we do this again with a different case. But check our sources, bottom of the show notes. Everything we talk about is referenced there. So let's get into who Herb Baumeister was. And he... Well, I'll just get into it. I was going to say something, but I'm just going to get into it.
I love our little pauses before we say something. It's like, oh, my God.
Yeah.
I can't believe we're fixing to say this.
Yeah. Well, that's most of what I'm going to talk about tonight is I can't believe I'm saying this. Now, Herb Baumeister was born April 7th, 1947 in Indianapolis, Indiana. He was the oldest of four kids, and he was born to Dr. Herbert Eugene Baumeister and Elizabeth Baumeister. Now, most of his childhood was typical for the time period. You know, he had a pretty good life growing up in the 40s and the 50s. You know, he wasn't beaten every day for little to no reason. He wasn't abandoned for long periods. And I say that because a lot of these experts try to tie your upbringing and how your parents treated you to your crimes later on in life. Now, he didn't have any of that. You know, he didn't have a bad childhood at all. It was a normal childhood. But while he was in school, starting pretty early on, he started to exhibit, quote, odd behaviors. You know, it started off with him being seen playing with dead animals that he would find on the side of the road or in the woods.
Yeah. You know, and that's one of those things we see often.
Mm-hmm.
Is some weird
infatuation with dead animals.
Either dead animals or hurting animals, killing animals. Yeah.
I didn't see anywhere that he actually hurt them, but he would play with dead animals that he found. And for some reason, what I picture is hand puppets. You know, he's just, I don't know why, but that's what, yeah, exactly. When you say playing with dead, I just picture him finding a squirrel on the side of the road and turning it into a puppet.
How funny.
But
yeah, he's got them talking to one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah. What size tire hit you? I don't know what size tire hit you.
Dead squirrel. Mm-hmm.
What did one dead squirrel say to the other dead? I don't know. Now, there was one day he even took a cow's head to school and he put it on his teacher's desk. So instead of leaving an apple for the teacher, he left a cow head for the teacher. Now, granted, I have a cow skull. I have multiple cow skulls in my house, but they're not just the full head, and I'm not leaving them for people as gifts. So,
right.
Now, he would also have frequent emotional outbursts in class, and these alarmed his fellow students and his teachers. And along with the emotional outburst, there were times that he would stand up and just urinate on desk in his classroom for no reason. Sometimes he'd do it right in front of other students. Sometimes he waited till they left the class, and then he would just go around peeing on desks in his classroom.
Gross.
Yeah. Gets grosser. Friends later recalled that he also seemed to be what they call a urophiliac.
Oh, like a urine fetish?
Uh-huh. He had a urine fetish. According to a Radford University report, he would often, quote, ponder what it would be like to taste human urine.
Oh, ugh.
Yeah.
I tell you what it's like. It's gross.
Yeah. Ask Bear Grylls. Bear Grylls will tell you. He drinks his own pee all the time. Well, because of all this, quote, odd behavior, his father got kind of freaked out by it. You know, father and mother were worried.
Rightfully so.
Exactly. They were worried about him, so they took him to a psychiatrist for an intervention. Now, at this point, he was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia and antisocial personality disorder. But I can't find if he got any sustained treatment for the issue or not. But being that this would be the 50s and 60s, I'm going to say he didn't.
Yeah, most likely.
Because
not for that, because
no.
If you think, I mean, I'm no expert, but a lot of these people were institutionalized.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't necessarily treated while in the community.
Right.
You know, they were, you know, placed in facilities and just medicated to so they were no danger.
Yep.
To themselves or anyone else. So that's not treatment. I mean, that's just, I mean, incarceration, really.
Yeah. And I'm not sure that they had any medication at the time that would actually fix that problem to be able to send him home.
Yeah.
You know, nowadays we have different prescriptions that will help with schizophrenia and antisocial personality disorder and stuff that if you take on a regular basis, it can help. Mm-hmm. With that. But in the 50s and 60s, they probably just gave stuff like Klonopin or whatever that put him down, and it really didn't help.
Yeah.
So my guess is because it doesn't, I couldn't find in the notes where it said he was treated for 25 years for that. They just kind of treated for a short period and then said, oh, he's fixed. It's like a cold. He just got over it. You know, we'll treat him for 14 days and he'll be over it.
But, well, and you know, even I think even today, you know, when children display behaviors like this, there's always that, well, they'll grow out of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a phase or whatever. You know, I imagine a lot of it is, but not
sometimes,
all
yeah.
of it.
Right.
You know.
Right. And that's why you need intervention from a psychiatrist or something to figure out if it's a phase or what. But we do know that for a time, he did start to exhibit, quote, normal social behavior. So at that point, he was able to return to school. But his classmates knew of all of his odd behaviors and his reputation that he had. So they shunned him and wouldn't let him play with them or hang out with them. So it kind of caused him to go further into himself, and
yeah.
It increased his reclusiveness, which if you've got antisocial personality disorder and then you're being shunned, it kind of validates that in you and makes you go further into yourself. It looks like Matt just shrunk.
My damn chair.
All right, he's back. If you're watching video, I might leave that in. And so if you're watching video, that might be a good show.
I was trying to do the little release so my chair would rock back. It got stuck, and I wound up releasing the thing, and I just dropped to the floor.
Well, I was looking at my notes, and then I turned back around, and I saw you shorter, and then you were just staring at me. So I was like, when I get through this thought, I'm going to figure out what's up.
Yeah, what is he doing?
Now, Herb did graduate from North Central High School in 1965. So he made it through his schooling, graduated high school, and then he enrolled for one semester at Indiana University, but he dropped out after that freshman semester. So he did. I don't know if this is good or bad. Like, I can't say luckily he, or if I should say unfortunately he, met his future wife, Julie Sater, there at Indiana University. So after that, he did re-enroll in 1967 for another semester, but he failed to complete a full degree at Indiana University. Well, then he enrolled in Butler University, but he had about the same tenure there. He would go for a semester, two semesters, and then he would drop out. And he never got a degree from either of those. He just attended and then dropped. Well, after this failed attempt at college, he then went and applied for a job at the Indianapolis Star. And he actually got a job there as a copy boy. But during his job as a copy boy at the Indiana Star, he continued having emotional outbursts and erratic behavior. So he was let go from there. And over the next few years, he kind of drifted between jobs. And at each one of them, he gained the reputation for bizarre behavior. He didn't hide it. He hid it long enough to get the job. And then once he had gotten his job and started working there, his weird, bizarre tendencies came out. In one case of that happening, he was fired from a job at the Indiana State Bureau of Motor Vehicles after he was caught urinating on a letter addressed to the Indiana governor.
Here we go with the pen on stuff again.
Yep. So he, at the Bureau of Motor Vehicles, they caught him peeing on a letter for the Indiana governor. Maybe he just didn't like the governor. I don't know.
Well, God,
it's true.
If he did that to somebody that he really liked,
yeah. What would he do to somebody he didn't like?
Golly.
Well, after losing this job, Baumeister then started working at a local thrift shop. Well, in 1971, he finally married Julie Sater, who was a high school journalism teacher. But only 6 months after they got married, Herb's father committed him to a psychiatric hospital for severe depression. So he had only been married for 6 months. Can you think about this from Julie's perspective? Mm-hmm. She marries this guy. 6 months later, his dad commits him to a psychiatric hospital.
Yeah.
You've got to be thinking, Lord, what did I get myself into?
Well,
either this man that I married is having issues, or his family is having issues and putting in there when he doesn't need to be.
And I know, when you're in a relationship and you legitimately care about another person, you know, you start blaming yourself. Well, I didn't know this, you know, has he been like this before? I mean, did something go wrong with our marriage that caused this? So,
true.
You know, can you imagine blaming yourself? And I mean, here this guy is, you know, who's had a history of these type problems. And, you know, here she is coming into this and witnesses all that, I mean, that's got to just kind of send you into a tailspin. I mean, you want him to get help.
Yep.
But you didn't know that he needed help to begin with.
Right. But that's that he could hide it for a short period of time, like he did with all his jobs. But after a short time period, he couldn't hide it anymore. Well, he was in this psychiatric hospital for 2 months. And then he got out, and Herb and Julie eventually, over the next few years, had 3 children together. So he and Julie lived in Indianapolis, and his neighbors recalled that he was an eccentric man. They said one day he would be overly accommodating to everyone around him, and then he would switch and be very hot-tempered to everybody. They said he exhibited other odd behaviors. He would distribute magazines that were discarded to his neighbors. So if you threw your magazines away in the trash, he would dig them out and then go hand them out to neighbors. Here's a fishing magazine for you. Oh, but here's a Maybelline catalog for you. And just randomly distribute these magazines. So nothing harmful with that. It's just weird.
Yeah. I mean, you got to, that's when people start going, you know, he's just an odd fellow, but this seems like he's legitimately trying to be neighborly.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just an odd habit.
Just one of those odd things that he does. But he would clash with the HOAs and the community associations over what everyone said were trivial matters. So it wasn't anything big, like, you know, you painted your house the wrong color. It was like, oh, well, you can't put a flag out in front of your yard. And he would throw a huge fit.
Yeah.
And whatever.
You left your trash can out too long.
Yeah, for 2 hours too long or something. Yeah. And I'm part of an HOA because of where we live. I get it. There's some stupid that HOAs have you do.
Yeah.
So I can't say much about his clashing with the HOA. That, to me, seems okay.
It's funny that this comes up because I had this conversation with a patient earlier today,
you know,
talking about, you know, the crazy stuff that their HOA would do, the weird rules, you know. It's like, why does it even matter?
Yeah, it doesn't matter. And HOAs are just power trips. But so I can't hold the clashing with the HOA against him. Hold everything else against him, but not the clashing with the HOA. Yeah. But, you know, during this time period, Herb seemed to everyone that saw him from the outside as just a hardworking entrepreneur. And I say entrepreneur because he founded the Save-A-Lot thrift store chain in 1988. And the thrift store was actually pretty successful for a time period.
Wow.
So he started work, you know, in a local thrift shop, and then he founded the whole Save-A-Lot thrift store. But within a few years of him starting this, the business began to fail. So the couple was having financial problems, and it put a strain on their marriage. And then Julie actually began spending weekends at her mother-in-law's condo after she took the kids with her. You know, she would, all right, I'm going to go spend the weekend at your mom's condo and take the kids and go over there. Now, Herb would stay behind because he claimed he needed to look after the store. Now, he also made quite a few business trips to Ohio around this same time period. And during that time period, there was a killer known as the I-70 Strangler that had begun murdering gay men and boys in Indianapolis. And we'll talk more about that here in a minute. But
and I've heard of that case.
Yep. So we'll talk more about that in a minute, but I have to bring it up because it fits in the timeline here. Now, in early 1991, Herb and Julie separated. They filed for divorce. But after a few months, they reconciled and got back together. So then in late 1991, Herb actually purchased an 18-acre estate called Fox Hollow Farm in Westfield, Indiana. They bought this property despite having ongoing financial troubles and the strain on their marriage. You know, I think they were hoping that it would, the move to another city and into another home and everything would actually help their marriage. But it was also around this time period that police suddenly stopped finding bodies along I-70.
Hmm.
So, interesting that he moves and the I-70 killer quits dumping bodies. But the property was a large ranch-style home that was built in 1978. It was located off 156th Street and the Monon Trail. And this became their family home. The estate was secluded. It had wooded areas and open land. Now, I couldn't find a public survey from that time that showed what the exact percentages of the property were woods versus open land, but they did say most of the property was wooded. And then the cleared open land was mainly, you know, in the residential piece, like where the house plot was and the yard around it. Now, the house also had a pool in the yard. And they say this was kind of a way that Herb would lure some of his victims back to his property. But the majority of the house being woods will play a significant role in Herb's crimes.
Mm-hmm.
During this time, he was able to outwardly maintain the appearance of a family man and a doting father. But Herb was actually leading a double life during this time. Now, this is where we get into the killings. So if you don't want to hear it, skip forward a little ways. Because it gets brutal, but not too bad. I'm not going to go into great detail on anything. I don't feel like talking about it.
Right.
And I don't think anybody feels like hearing about it. So yeah. We'll just briefly touch the highlights. Now, Herb would actually frequent gay bars in Indiana and Ohio. And he would find different young men in these bars. And it's believed that he would bring them back to his Fox Hollow farm and strangle them. After he killed his victims, he would first burn their bodies. Then he would crush what's left of their burnt body down to more of an ash and bone chunks mix. And he would then take those crushed remains and bury them in the wooded areas of Fox Hollow Farm.
Hmm.
So, brutal. Let's look at some key events that led to him being suspected in these disappearances. Now, in 1992, a man named Tony Harris saw Baumeister, who at the time was using the alias Brian Smart, leave an Indianapolis gay bar with Roger Goodlett, who later went missing. As Harris told it, he had met Smart at a gay bar. Then the two hit it off, though Harris noted that Smart expressed an unusual interest in the missing persons case of Harris's friend, Roger Goodlett. He spent a lot of the night staring at Goodlett's missing poster that was hanging in the bar. The two men eventually headed back to Smart's Indiana estate, where Smart initiated a sexual encounter. He suggested they try erotic asphyxiation. Well, Harris agreed. Well, Smart then began to choke Harris with a pool hose, and he didn't stop, squeezing until Harris began to lose consciousness. Panicked, Harris pretended to pass out so that Smart would release him. Harris somehow managed to escape, but the terrifying ordeal led to him to suspect that Brian Smart might be the one behind his friend's disappearance. In 1995, the same witness saw Baumeister again at the bar, and he followed him. This time he took down his license plate. But when the police ran Smart's license plate, they said it didn't come back to Brian Smart at all. It was Herb Baumeister's car. So they found out this is Herb Baumeister that's pretending to be Brian Smart. Now, around that same time, Baumeister's son found a human skull on the family's Fox Hollow Farm property.
Oh, man.
But Baumeister dismissed it as a fake and, you know, convinced Julie that it was part of a anatomical display that he had of fake bones, of a fake human body. So,
'cause you just have those.
Yeah, yeah. You just randomly have those.
Nowadays, though, I mean, everybody's got skulls and stuff from Halloween decorations.
Yep.
But
yep.
I don't know that that was as common, you know, around this time in the 90s.
Yeah, I don't know. Now, later in 1995, Julie first got approached about searching the Fox Hollow Farm because the police suspected Herb in a murder, but she initially refused. Okay, so a few months go by, and in 1996, Julie remembered that their son had found that skull. And she started to question whether it was actually part of an anatomical display, like Herb had said. Mm-hmm. So she actually consented to the police for them to search the farm while Herb was out of town. Because her and her sons actually found additional bones on the estate. So they're like, I just found more bones. Our kid found this skull. The police are suspecting him. He might be up to something. So they consented to the police searching the farm when Herb was out of town. At this same time, Julie went and filed for divorce again. Smart woman.
Yeah.
Now, during this police search, police found over 10,000 bone fragments on the farm. So that confirmed that there were multiple bodies being buried on the property. Investigators spent weeks excavating wooded areas on the farm, putting together fragmented bones and evidence of Baumeister's victims. Now, when the police first started this search, Herb was already on the run to Canada. When they started that search, he went, ah, crap, and he took off. Now, all of these pieces put together led law enforcement to identify Baumeister as the suspect in a series of murders of young men during the 1990s. Now, at this point, Herb knew, you know, he was suspected for all these disappearances and murders. So, like I said, he fled to Canada. But before the police could have him arrested in Canada, he committed suicide in Pinery Provincial Park on July 3rd, 1996, which the cops said that then solidified their suspicions of his guilt.
Yeah, that absolutely would do it.
Right. He did leave a suicide note, but it had no traces of a confession in it. And the police never had a chance to interrogate him about the remains found on his property, let alone charge him with anything, with kidnapping or murder or anything. But based on all the remains that they found on the estate, it's widely believed amongst people and the police that he was responsible for this long string of murders that stretched all the way back into the 1980s. And I brought up the I-70 strangler. He was also suspected to be that strangler, or at least be connected with the I-70 strangler murders, because they had uncovered the naked or partially clothed bodies of a dozen men and boys near Interstate 70 between Indiana and Ohio. They dubbed this killer the I-70 strangler, and he had apparently met his victims in popular gay bars in Indianapolis, then strangled them to death before dumping their bodies in rivers, streams, and ditches in the rural areas surrounding the interstate. And like I said,
golly,
oddly, these bodies stopped turning up in 91 when he moved with his wife and children to Fox Hollow Farm. So kind of said, yeah, that seems like he's connected to that.
I mean, it does. And I mean, how many cases could you say this guy was actually two different serial killers?
Right.
And, you know, like I said at the very beginning, he has 11 confirmed murders, but those are only the ones that were confirmed.
Right.
So, you know, if he was who they called the I-70 Strangler, he's got that many more. Plus, as we kind of talk about what his property was like, they weren't really sure, because of the sheer number of remains they found, how many total victims he could have had right there.
Right. And that, I mean, that's the thing. Investigation continues to this day with more victims identified through DNA analysis that started happening in the 2020s.
Yeah.
So it took till the 2020s before DNA could pinpoint some of these individuals that were found on his farm. Now, as of 2025, they say at least 25 individuals that they suspect to be Baumeister's victims, with ongoing efforts to identify further remains. So like Matt said, they can confirm 11, they suspect at least 25, and the case and the remains are still the subject of active investigation due to new DNA techniques that keep popping up. And those techniques are helping them identify more and more victims.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's look at least 10 of the victims that were positively identified as of 2025 to give them the respect that they deserve. John Lee Johnny Bayer, 20. He went missing in May of 93. Jeff Jones, 31, went missing in July of 93. Richard Hamilton, 20, went missing in July of 93. So he was busy. Alan Livingston, 27, missing August 1993. They identified him in 2023. Stephen Hale, 28, missing in April of 94. Alan Broussard, missing in June of 94. Roger Goodlett, who we talked about, he went missing in July of 94. Robert Resendez, he was last seen August of 93, and they identified his remains in 2024. Michael Cairn was 45, last seen March of 95, and Daniel Holleran went missing in 1993, and they identified his body in 2025. Now, there's been a monument that was dedicated in 2024 at Fox Hollow Farm to honor all of his victims. Now, we might never really know exactly how many people Herb Baumeister killed. But if he was the I-70 killer as well as the Fox Hollow Farm killer, the death toll would make him the most prolific serial killer in the history of Indiana.
Wow.
And like you said at the beginning of this, I don't know why I haven't heard more about this. I'm sure there might be some podcasts that do it. There might be some shows that do it, but I would feel like this would be a very talked about case.
Yeah. And not only would it be, you know, highly talked about, outside of the killing, his residence, Fox Hollow Farm, has been talked about extensively because of the paranormal activity that goes on mm-hmm. there. And this was another one I was kind of like, how have I not just casually come across this? Because we'll get into it. There have been books, there have been TV series. I mean, you know, magazine articles, you name it. There have been so much that focused on the farm itself and the haunted activity that goes on there. And it is widely considered to be one of the most haunted places in Indiana. They say,
I can see why.
Yeah. And they say that it's supposed to be haunted by the spirits of the victims and possibly Baumeister himself, which is unusual, but it's not unheard of because he didn't die there. You know, I mean, he fled to Canada before he took himself out. But there are numerous eyewitness accounts. There are just so many different ghost stories and paranormal investigations that contribute to this haunted history of Fox Hollow Farm. Now, as we talked about, it was the site of at least 11 confirmed murders, and they were all young men who disappeared from, you know, Indianapolis's nightlife in the 90s. Now, Baumeister buried the remains of his victim across the property, and they said it left behind thousands of bone fragments. So, you know, like I said, he's not just burying a body. I mean, he's desecrating these bodies and spreading them all over his property.
And the wooded areas, I was reading, really helped him be able to conceal that.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, he's got this acreage. But if you got open ranch, like a lot here in Texas, you got open ranch, your neighbors, even though they're half mile away, could still see you doing weird stuff in the yard.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
If you've got a wooded section that you're doing all of this in, it kind of helps you go unnoticed.
Yeah. So the best place to get the information on the hauntings is from the people that live there.
Mm-hmm.
Rob Graves and his wife, Vicky, purchased Fox Hollow Farm in May of 2009. Now, Rob says, and this is a quote, he says, "It all started with my wife seeing a guy in the woods." Rob said, the man that she saw was walking around wearing a bright red shirt, but he didn't have any legs.
Yeesh.
And he said she had seen it twice before she told him. And
just had to make sure she wasn't going crazy, I'm sure.
And I found a story where Rob is talking about they're having a conversation, and Vicky like looks and you know, where there's something going on behind you and you're unaware of it, but the person you're talking to sees it, and you can tell that they're almost looking through you, past you.
Yeah.
And this is what happened. And he's like, "What?" And she's like, "Nothing. You know, I saw somebody out there in the woods walking around, and he was wearing a bright red shirt, but he just disappeared." And so Rob is like, "Well, he didn't just disappear. You know, he must have moved and got out of sight. There was, you know, maybe some low-lying fog and you couldn't see his legs. But this was his property, and I don't think anybody takes too kindly to somebody just roaming around on their property."
No. Nope.
Without at I'd least knowing, what are you doing here?
Yeah.
So he says he goes out there to try to find who was out there, and he searches around, and he said, "I couldn't find anyone, much less a guy wearing a bright red shirt."
Much less a guy with no legs.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, well, I found the guy with a bright red shirt. He had two legs. So that obviously wasn't the same guy.
Wasn't the guy you saw. Yep.
But this particular spirit has been dubbed, any guesses?
The good look guy.
Oh, you're adding way more than the red shirt man.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, I should have known it would have been like the woman in the white dress.
Yeah, the woman in white. This is the red shirt man.
Yep.
And yeah,
I thought they were gonna name him.
Yeah, no, that's kind of what I thought too when I was reading this. But no, he's the red shirt man, and he wanders around the woods, and he's been seen by not only Rob and Vicky, but other people have reported seeing him as well.
Oh wow!
So Rob Graves contacted a paranormal group, and they were out on the farm a year before the Graves moved in, this particular paranormal group.
Jeez.
And he told Rob then, the guy from the investigator group, he said, this is the most haunted house in Indiana.
Oh, wow.
Can you imagine owning a property? Some weird stuff happens, and then a paranormal investigator comes to your house and goes, yeah, we were here last year.
Yeah.
This, your house is the most haunted house in Indiana. Congratulations. I'd be like, man, right. It's taking all I can not to punch you in the nose right now.
You couldn't have given me a heads up. You obviously knew I bought this because you were here and I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And then now it's got new owners. You could have said something.
Yeah. This should be on the Zillow listing, for crying out loud. Yeah,
right. Right. You know, there are some states that are requiring that now.
If it's haunted?
If it's haunted, they have to put in the property thing, they have to suspect it haunting.
Yes.
In the property.
Because you know there are people going, filter by suspected haunting.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I want a haunted house.
Look at this one, sweetheart. It's a lovely 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch style home with 4 confirmed spirits.
Right.
We're
3-bedroom, 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 4 spirit.
Yeah.
Like, wait, did you add a category? Yeah. Oh yeah, they Zillow is adding how many spirits are on the property.
That's
now.
Exactly,
so.
Right. It's right under baths. You know, you can find spirits.
This one's only got 2. I like the four ghost one.
Yeah. Yeah. Have anyone with just with female ghosts? Mm-hmm. Like, will you stop?
Yeah. Yeah. Do they have any that have a half ghost?
Yeah. Yeah. What? No legs. You know.
I can't do a full ghost. I don't think we can afford a full ghost, honey. Let's go for a half ghost.
So, but Rob says this investigator looks at him and goes, "Let me tell you what she saw and where she saw it." And he goes, he was shocked when this total stranger repeated exactly what his wife had seen word for word.
Wow.
So he's like, he already knew and knew where.
Jeez.
Now, another strange occurrence took place in the basement. Now, I'll give credit here, but I found this particular blurb about this many times, but I found the longer form story from Vicky. Okay. And this is the one I messaged Adam and I was like, I found this awesome story. So this is
great. I'm looking forward to this.
So this one takes place in the basement. Okay. And understand the pool. Okay. They've got like an indoor pool. Okay. I was trying to kind of piece it together when I was reading about Fox Hollow Farm, what it looked like. And I finally realized, this pool is enclosed and it's like basement level. So that's where this happened. And Rob said that the vacuum gets unplugged continuously, despite there having a long enough cord. And he says, we have to say, stop unplugging the vacuum. We got a word, okay? And he said, once you say that, it'll stop. But he says it happens routinely. But the first
time. That's
like
the ghost at my Hendersonville house.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you had to tell him, quit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, calm down, man. I got to work in the morning.
I got to get up in the morning, man. Quit stomping around. So But as I said, the story of Vicky's actual experience with this vacuum is so much more intriguing. And this story is told in Richard Estep's book, The Horrors of Fox Hollow Farm. So I've got to give credit. That's where this comes from, you know, from Richard Estep's book. Now, Vicky says the boys had tracked dirt onto the floor in the indoor pool room, which is located in the basement. She got out the vacuum and started to clean. Now, it's important to note here that Vicky is a scientist by trade, according to Estep. So, dwelling on paranormal activity and ghosts is not her thing. She was focused on vacuuming, and she was surprised when the vacuum suddenly shut off. So, puzzled, she looks around and notices that the cord had come out of the electrical outlet. You know, we've all done that. You know, you're vacuuming, you're trying to get a little bit further, and I can, so I don't have to unplug and replug. Boonk. And you're like, oh, damn it. You know, I'm at the end. Yep. Okay. So that is what she thought had happened. She had gotten to the end of the cord and inadvertently pulled it out. So she plugged it back in and resumed her work. But just shortly thereafter, the vacuum died again.
Huh.
So now she's getting kind of frustrated, and Vicky looks back at the plug and once again notices that it's not in the socket. But this time, she took note that there was plenty of slack in the line, and the plug was more than a foot away from the wall socket. Now,
definitely wasn't her that pulled it out.
Right. Now, she knew she couldn't have pulled it out this time. And it certainly didn't just fall out of the outlet that far on its own. Like, you ever had an outlet that you needed to replace and stuff just wouldn't stay plugged in there?
Yeah. Okay. It just droops and falls out.
It just falls out. Yeah. It doesn't fall a foot away.
No. It doesn't fly out.
Right. Now, moments later, now she's really confused at this point. And so she plugs it back in thinking, this is really weird. But she wasn't thinking anything paranormal.
Mm-hmm.
But moments later, the plug came out again, and this time, Vicky was actually watching it and saw it fly out of the outlet as if someone forcibly pulled it from the wall.
Wow.
Now, if witnessing this wasn't enough, Vicky says it was then that she felt that she wasn't alone in the pool room. Now, she's quoted in Richard Estep's book as saying, I felt like someone was there, and I got the strong sense that this invisible someone didn't want me to be in there with them. That's what I said. Now, that is an awesome story as far as, you know, a personal one-on-one encounter. I mean, to actually witness that kind of stuff.
Yeah, coming out of the wall and everything.
And to get that sensation. That feeling.
That sensation in your own home is too much.
Yeah. But we all know it. I mean, you think about it. I mean, so I know people will say, it's a weird feeling. Well, listen, if you've ever been in your house and you maybe thought you were alone in a room or whatever, and someone walks into that room quietly, doesn't announce themselves, and you don't see them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't make any sound. They don't creak the floor or nothing. You know, I am not alone anymore. There is someone in here. And you turn around, and sure enough, you know, there's somebody walked in. Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't want to disturb you. You were reading or studying or whatever. But you get that feeling. You have that.
You felt them.
You have that sense.
Mm-hmm.
So to get that, and to know well that you are alone in this room. There is no one else. Nobody has walked. Rob didn't walk in. You know, you're by yourself, and then you get that feeling, I'm not by myself.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's terrifying.
It is. I get that feeling. Michael tries to scare me all the time.
Yeah.
And so he'll try to sneak up on me, and he's gotten me a time or two, but most of the time I know he's coming, and he's like, how did you know I was in here? I'm like, I don't know. Yeah. I just knew you were in here. And it's that sense of there being somebody in the room.
Right. It happened to me today at a patient's house. I mean, I just, as we're talking about this, I got to thinking, when I got there, I know this patient well, and his wife is usually there with him, but she had a doctor's appointment. So he had told me she's not here, you know, and I said, okay. And this guy, his hearing is not the best, but I, on multiple occasions, am hearing what, their mice wear boots around here. You know, what in the heck am I hearing?
Yeah.
And this went on for like 30 minutes. I would hear it. You know, I'm working with him. He's not hearing anything. And if he was, he wasn't saying anything, but I brought it up and he said, no, I didn't hear it. So his wife gets home while I'm there. And he asks, he goes, where's so-and-so, which was their grandson. She's like, he's upstairs. He's like, what? She's like, yeah, he didn't come with me. And I said, I knew there was somebody else in this house.
Had to have been.
I'm like, otherwise, I'm going crazy. He's telling me we're alone. And I'm like, we're not alone, dude. What's going on? And it was his grandson upstairs.
There you go.
But like I said, I knew there was someone else in that house. But anyway, I digress. One of Rob's coworkers, a guy named Joe LeBlanc, he rented an apartment that was on the property. It's kind of like the in-laws apartment, you know, that was there. And so he had come out, you know, Rob had mentioned something to him. He come out. It was perfect. He's like, man, this is perfect. So he moved in. But Joe has had multiple unexplained experiences while living out there. Like having his door kicked in.
No.
It knocks on the door, stumbling, you think you hear footsteps. That's one thing. Having your stinking door kicked in.
Yeah.
Wrong.
I'm moving at that point.
But he says, you know, knocking on the door in the middle of the night or just anywhere, deadbolted doors whipping open and items being moved overnight. You know, things like taken from one location to another.
See, the moving stuff, the knocking, I can deal with.
Mm-hmm.
It's the opening a deadbolted door or kicking a door in. That's when I'm out.
Think about the amount of energy that it would require to open a deadbolted door.
Yep. But kick a dang door
in. Kick it in, yeah. Wrong. Mm-mm. I ain't dealing with that. I'm moving on. Rob, I appreciate the opportunity. I'm out.
Yep. Somebody doesn't want me here. I don't want to be here anymore. That's right. So.
But LeBlanc says that he's also seen the red shirt man and other spirits, as well as experiencing horrific nightmares. In Richard Estep's book, he tells a story. LeBlanc tells a story about, like, the first night he was there, he has this terrible nightmare that he's being chased through the woods. And he said he just has this feeling he can't see anything. He doesn't know what's going on, but he's just got this, I need to run. He's like, and he wakes up, you know, almost in a panic. But he kind of passed it off because at some point, Vicky and Rob had shared the history of the house with him. So he knew. And he's thinking, this was just fresh on my mind, and it caused me to have a nightmare. I think any reasonable person would think that's it.
Your subconscious playing at night.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But not hearing a story doesn't equate to having your door kicked in.
Exactly right. Exactly right. I say it. I'm done at that point.
Yep.
Sorry. Done.
Now, paranormal investigators consistently report a sense of unease on the farm, as if they're being observed by some unseen force in the shadows.
Guarantee it, they are.
Like from the woods.
Mm-hmm.
Psychics that have visited the farm say there is a disturbing energy that creates a hum that permeates just below the surface of the land.
Hmm.
Which, I mean, that tracks. I mean, he buried all these remains all over his property. I mean, that, you know, I would imagine. Now, investigators and psychics report supernatural phenomena at Fox Hollow Farm, from temperature drops to disembodied voices and EVPs that are captured near the pool where many of Baumeister's victims perished, reveal whispers and faint cries for help. Oh, but geez. Here's the kicker. The responses seem conscious. They react to investigators in real time, which leads you to believe that there's something more than just a residual haunting. Yeah. You're not seeing the stone tape style haunting. You're not seeing history just playing out. Something's there and realizes that there is somebody to communicate with.
Yeah, right.
Psychics have determined that the pool room and some of the bathrooms carry this uneasy energy and may serve as a gateway or portal between our world and the spiritual realm. And Vicky Graves agrees, because she says there are some rooms that she just doesn't want to enter. You know, as soon as she goes in, hair on the back of her neck. I mean, just, you know, just
could have been,
walking in the door.
Could have been the rooms he killed people.
Could it be? I mean, it absolutely could be. And Rob says, this is a quote from Rob. He says, there are places in my house my wife does not like to go that make her hair stand up on the back of her neck. And one of these spots is Rob's bathroom, which psychics described as, like I said, a portal for spirits to come and go, which would make you think, okay, now not only are you dealing with the spirits of Baumeister's victims, you might be dealing with other spirits that are drawn there because of the energy, which would explain why some of them seem so violent. You know, you wouldn't imagine these murder victims necessarily being
to be violent.
You would think maybe they're just trying to get your attention. But it's gone, you know, even further than just doors kicked in and stuff like that. So these EVPs, it says the voices don't just linger. They seem to be aware of human presence.
Yeah.
So when they go back and listen to these recordings, it appears that they are getting answers to questions
that
come in real time. And I mean, we've all heard those before, you know, on some of these shows and things like that, but it never really seems like there's a conversation going on. It's always like, ask a question. Wait, you hear something and they go, oh, that said, you know, Elizabeth or something. And like, okay, maybe, I mean, it's pretty close, you know, but to have answers to questions come when you listen to both things together, you know, that's gotta be creepy. I mean, just
creepy. It kind of gives you chills just thinking about it. Yeah.
Now, Joe LeBlanc, who I was talking about earlier, he's the renter that was living there on the property.
Yeah.
He reports going swimming in the pool one day. And he...
I don't think I'd want to do that.
I know. But he felt something grab him behind his neck while he's swimming. LeBlanc was alone at the time, and Joe says whatever grabbed him seemed to be trying to force him under the water. So that, like I said, it gets a little bit more aggressive. Now, Rob says he has seen a shadow figure move from right to left through the pool room at various times. While filming the documentary Haunting of Fox Hollow Farm, director Dan T. Hall recounts, it was about 12:30 PM and we were using an infrared camera and heard someone come up behind us. He's like, I'm skeptical, but that was a little unnerving.
Yeah.
You know, Apparitions of young men are also commonly reported around the farm, and like I said, many believe that these are the spirits of Baumeister's victims, which makes sense.
Yep.
Psychics who have studied the farm say that the combination of these young men's untimely and gruesome deaths, the massive volume of skeletal fragments found buried, and the evil that Herb Baumeister displayed tie these spirits to the area, leaving them searching for closure or justice. And because I would imagine there are so many that are unidentified, that lends to a lot of the unrest as well. Because like you said, you know, they're even what up till just a few years ago, they're still identifying remains that are, you know, that have been found using DNA.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting. We've heard of serial killers that use this method of luring gay men from these nightclubs, you know, to back to their homes to become their victims.
Mm-hmm.
And one article I read, and this is what it describes, is that he chose, or it appears that he chose his victims this way because there was in this writer's eyes, there was a less chance that this was someone that was going to be missed, which is a crappy thing to say about a human life, but you've heard it whenever you read about serial killers that, you know, that they're looking for people that are on the outer edge of life. You know, they're not pillars of the community. You know, they're not well-known people. Maybe they're estranged from their family for whatever reason. You know, maybe they're, you know, drug addicted, you know, possibly even, you know, semi-homeless. You know, so it appears that Baumeister thought that if one of these people or some of these people go missing, there's less of a chance that there's somebody that's going to notice that they're missing, mm-hmm. you know, that maybe they don't have any family. And quite possibly, you know, striking up a conversation, becoming friendly with someone enough to convince them to come home with you, you would have bound to have learned a little bit about this person. And it's quite possible that he was saying, you know, hey, you got any, where are you from? You know, oh, you grew up in Los Angeles. Okay. You got family here? What did you come here? No, you by yourself here. You know, new to town, huh? You know, do you communicate with your parents or your brothers and sisters? No, not really. Okay. And, you know, kind of making mental notes to go, if this guy just vanished, you know, there may not be anyone that comes looking for him for a long time. Mm-hmm. And it helps him cover his tracks. So, you know, that in and of itself, I think, you know, would contribute to the unrest after death, you know, that maybe these victims were in a state of unrest during life. And it's difficult for their spirit to move on. You know, wherever they were in a phase of where they weren't connected well. And here comes somebody that seems to be a new connection. And this, you know, terrible individual took advantage of that.
Yeah.
And I mentioned at the top, and this was, I told Adam, I found this in two sources, but I found nothing else about it, that the idea that Baumeister's spirit also haunts this area. Now, I couldn't find anything else about a spirit that they directly attributed to Herb Baumeister. But I got thinking, and I'm really not being facetious, but how horrible a fate would it be to be violently murdered, have your spirit trapped to haunt the site of your death, and then have to be with the spirit of the that murdered you.
The guy who killed you, yeah.
I mean, talking about just pouring salt in the wound,
Yeah, that'd be horrible.
I'm like, I've never heard that before. You know, the spirit of the victims and the murderer are hanging around, you know, it's nuts. But this case, you know, it is a gruesome and horrible case, and the paranormal activity that it left behind is fascinating, you know, for all these people to have experienced this on this property. Consistently, it's not like every once in a while, consistently, you know, they are interacting with this.
The bathroom being called a portal.
Right.
So stuff can come and go. For one, you don't want to have a portal on your property that allows just whatever entity to come and go as it pleases.
Right.
But I also don't want it being my bathroom.
You're right.
Because I try to go in my bathroom to relax.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, get away from stuff. I don't want to be sitting in there and it be like Grand Central Station for spirits coming and going.
I don't need any ghosts watching me try to poop.
Right.
I personally would have been, I would be like, we need to get out of here long before this thing attacked Joe LeBlanc in the pool.
Yeah.
If I wasn't already gone, that would have sealed the deal. I mean, look, I grew up in the kind of environment where weird stuff happened and we all kind of joked. Nothing malevolent ever took place. Mm-hmm. I have never experienced what I thought was a dangerous or evil haunting personally. I know that if I had, I would have been like, this is not where I want to be.
Yep. Time to go.
But the graves, despite all of this unexplainable activity, say that they have no intention of moving. They said, we love it here and we want to change the dynamics of what was, which I can, you know, kudos to them for saying, you know, we're going to take this place, you know, that such evil, you know, happened, and we're going to turn it into a place of love and kindness and everything. Mm-hmm. I'm with you. I think that's admirable. It's terrifying, but it's admirable.
And it's cool that they've got the gumption to stick it out.
Yeah. I'm serious, man. I love talking about this stuff. I love reading about it. You know, I've had plenty of experiences on my own, but at some point, enough's got to be enough. You know, it would be for me.
Well, when it gets malevolent,
when
it tries to harm you or anybody else, or you get the feeling of not being wanted, you know, if there were rooms in my house that I was terrified to go into because of an entity, I think I would have to find someplace else. Because I don't want to be kept from anywhere in my house by forces beyond my control.
So this is the part of the show where we ask that famous question, what do you think? Do you think that quite possibly Fox Hollow Farm is haunted by a serial killer's victims and possibly even the serial killer himself? Do you think this is just some... You know, they don't tour this place. So, I mean, you know, it's not like they're getting rich by telling these stories.
Somebody lives here.
You know, too many outside people have had experiences for me to dismiss, you know, directors, authors, you know, they've come, paranormal investigators, they've all come and had very, very similar experiences. It seems like a pretty solid story to me. And it's a good one. You know, it's a good one. If you want to look into it, I listed out Richard Estep's book, The Haunting of Fox Hollow Farm. There is a documentary. The Horrors of Fox Hollow Farm, that is the book by Richard Estep. Haunting of Fox Hollow Farm, that is Dan Hall's documentary about it. There are other books, there are TV series. It's been on Investigation Discovery. It's been on Paranormal Witness. It's been featured on the History Channel, True TV, A&E. So you can go search this stuff out if this case interests you. The other thing that Adam and I would like to know is, how did you enjoy this, yes, this mashup of true crime and paranormal activity? I liked it. I dig mm-hmm. it. I think it's a cool
yep.
thing to kind of push these two genres together. Because we found a few others, you know, that have yep. this connection. If you enjoyed, you know, having a little true crime mixed in with your ghost stories, then let us know. We'd love to try this again. Don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcast, iTunes. It really does help the show. Check out our Facebook group. It's called The Graveyard. You want to let us know, hey, we kind of like this, or no, this was terrible. We'll listen to another true crime show if we want that. Our yep. Facebook group is the best place to let us know and voice your opinion. And we appreciate everybody that interacts in our group. It's tons of people. It's a lot of fun. A lot of great stories come out of there. Our website, graveyardpodcast.com. There you can find links to purchase Graveyard Tales merchandise, t-shirts, coffee mugs, travel tumblers. What was the new shorts? We got shorts now.
Shorts, yep.
So you can, you know,
and hats, yeah, on
shorts
there.
And hats, you know, I guarantee you, you know, it hard to believe, but Christmas, you know, will be here before you know it. If you've got a member of the Graveyard on your Christmas list, it's a good time to go check out our merch store. And, we appreciate it. We don't get rich from that. Not even close, but,
no,
but we appreciate people willing to, you know, promote the show by wearing our logos. It really makes us feel good, man. This is we told you it's going to be a ride tonight.
Yep. It sure was.
But until next time, we'll save you a seat in the graveyard.
See you soon.